this is a key ingredient to how we will see development of our outer continental shelf areas.
Senator Murkowski calls for federal revenue sharing for oil and gas development off Alaska's shores. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, economist Robert Reich has some advice for Alaska. Diversify.
To base an entire economy or a large part of an economy on natural resources is potentially dangerous.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state, business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski introduced a bill today that would grant states a portion of oil revenues from offshore drilling. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it comes the same day the House passed its own bill that would expand offshore drilling.
Senator Murkowski is the lead sponsor of the bill, and by day's end, it had 8 co-sponsors, 4 Republicans and 4 Democrats, including Senator Mark Begich. It would grant states 37.5% of revenue generated from offshore drilling on the Outer Continental Shelf. That's federal land. Under current law, the state gets no share of federal offshore drilling revenue. It only collects royalties from companies drilling in closer state waters. Murkowski says revenue sharing is a way to gain support in the Senate.
On the perspective of many of the coastal states, this is a key ingredient to how we will see development of our outer continental shelf areas.
The bill, like one passed in the U.S. House Wednesday afternoon, would speed up lease sales. The Department of Interior would need to hold a lease sale for Cook Inlet and the Chukchi Sea next year, 3 years ahead of schedule. Bruce Tangeman is the deputy commissioner for Alaska's Department of Revenue. He says the state is completely behind Senator Murkowski's plan, and the 37.5% rate seems reasonable.
Right now it's zero, so with the potential for the tremendous resource on the Outer Continental Shelf in Alaska, this would be a fair compromise for the state of Alaska, especially considering that we're seeing a decline from oil produced on state lands.
Tangeman says his agency does not know what kind of windfall this could create. They have not made any predictions because the amount of offshore oil and gas is unknown. It's still premature for people to get too excited about fattening state coffers. Last year, revenue sharing derailed a safety bill it was bundled to. And there are regional issues. Most Republicans in the House support offshore drilling, but some from states like New Jersey are opposed to it. But the House bill did not have the added incentive of added money. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
This spring, Hillcorp Alaska announced plans to reopen the Drift River Terminal oil storage facility on the west side of Cook Inlet. Hillcorp's announcement raised concerns about the safety of the terminal because it's at the base of Redoubt Volcano. Calls have been made for construction of a pipeline to transfer oil to the east side of the inlet for processing, most recently by the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, or CIRCAC. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
The position paper released by CIRCAC is another in a growing chorus of voices supporting a safer, more permanent solution to the problem of getting oil across Cook Inlet. The group released a report Wednesday which concluded that a pipeline would be the best way to do that. Here's CIRCAC Executive Director Michael Munger.
The proximity of the Drift River Terminal, it certainly has weathered 2 eruptions since 1990. Their engineering and stuff has certainly held up, but we feel ultimately this would be a solution to many of the issues that came up during those eruptions. And so that's the basis of our position paper, and we'd like to see a subsea pipeline installed within 5 years after the potential reopening of the facility.
Hillcorp's plans to reopen Drift River are still being worked through the permitting process, but could be finalized this year. Following the 2009 eruption, Hillcorp bought the facility from Chevron and had several engineering, safety, and design changes to put in place before the facility could reopen. In the time since then, other companies have made moves to get a pipeline constructed that could serve the entire area. In June, Cook Inlet Energy announced their application for permits to build such a line, a project for which CEO David Hall says there is now a healthy business case.
You know, as it will, you know, dramatically lower our transportation costs from what it is today. The other element that it provides is just the reliability of it. You know, it would be a new line, of course, and, you know, hopefully provide many, many years of safe transportation.
Munger says the group supports a pipeline because, essentially, it simplifies things. CERCAC found in a section of its risk assessment study done earlier this year that, not surprisingly, more vessels in Cook Inlet increase the risk of an accident or spill, and evacuating Drift River in the event of another readout eruption would almost certainly see more traffic.
The tanker traffic is increased quite a bit from their conventional system prior to the eruption, and more retention time because they aren't using the Drift River facility pumps to load the tanker. So you have vastly increased tanker retention time at the dock, and then you have significantly more tanker traffic because they can't store as much oil over there.
Representatives from Hillcorp couldn't be reached for this story, but back in May, spokesperson Lori Nelson said plans were well underway to beef up the facility, which houses four tanks that each hold 270,000 barrels of oil. If approved and built, the pipeline being proposed by Cook Inlet Energy would have a carrying capacity large enough to take care of the transportation needs of more than one company. Here's Hall again.
Anybody could, produce into it and just pay the set throughput charge. You know, our thought was it would be a published, you know, transportation rate.
While the pipeline plan is most desirable from CERCAC's perspective, Munger adds that the updated plan Hillcorp has in place for Drift River satisfies a need to mitigate risk in the short term.
We feel that's a far safer method or a far environmentally sound method than currently what they're doing. Less tanker traffic, less retention time at the dock only makes sense, especially in the winter conditions.
CERCAC is a nonprofit group funded in part through a partnership of energy companies operating in Cook Inlet known as the Charter Funding Companies, which does include Cook Inlet Energy, among others. From Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
The committee that handles the year-round business affairs of the legislature today approved money for an in-depth inspection and report on the structural integrity of the state capitol in Juneau. The Legislative Council agreed to pay $149,000 for design development to follow up on studies done in 2006 and 2010. Those studies found problems with the old masonry and were heightened recently when a legislative staff employee was nearly hit by a falling piece of the building. Chugiak Republican Bill Stoltz originally objected to the expenditure, saying he didn't want to dredge up a divisive issue like moving the Capitol, but he did want to consider it.
If there are potential structural problems with the existing Capitol site, I would like to have a much broader discussion about whether there might be better locations to build a legislative hall.
Juneau Democratic Senator Dennis Egan said those issues have nothing to do with its current structural integrity.
It's the state capitol building. Houses the governor, lieutenant governor, and every member of the legislature. I would hate to see this structure go into any more disrepair than it currently is. I think the $149,000 that was approved by the legislature, this is just to authorize it, is money well spent. We have to know what's wrong with that building.
Capitol Building Manager Don Johnston told the committee that the proposed project would only report on the condition of the building, something that should be done whether it is the Capitol or a state office building anywhere.
That, at the very least, needs to be done. It's not going to have anything to do with any construction costs. You know, we can go through with this phase, get their reports, and at that point decide whether moved on to phase four and five. Not to mention, we're talking about some safety, very, very serious safety issues with portions of the building right now.
Stoltz proposed an amendment that would clarify that the study was to advise the legislature on, quote, potential life and or health and or safety concerns. Work will be done this fall by masonry expert Paul Lukes. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a big influx of seniors has the Matsu Valley struggling to keep up with services.
Matsu is one of the only places in the state of Alaska where the in-migration of seniors is greater than the out-migration of seniors.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Public policy professor and former Clinton Labor Secretary Robert Reich is in Anchorage this week. The Berkeley economist is a prolific author and commentator on the current plight of the global economy. He has some thoughts about Alaska's economy, too. He thinks natural gas is set to become a primary energy source for developed nations. And given that, he doesn't think Congress should ban natural gas exports, as one Democratic representative has proposed.
I don't think it makes any sense to try to prevent exports of gas. That's kind of silly. The big problem with gas has to do with how you get it to the market. I mean, you do need pipelines, or you can try liquefied natural gas, but that's very expensive to do. I think we will be doing more of that in the future. Gas is going to be probably in the not too distant future, a major, if not the major, source of energy for us and for many other developed nations around the world and developing nations.
Sometimes it seems like Alaska is on the brink of the next big thing. Perhaps that's just wishful thinking by Alaskans. But in addition to vast stores of gas and gas hydrates, we've got rare earth mineral potential here. In pondering Alaska's economic future, what do you think we'll see in this resource extraction realm?
Well, look, China is the big wild card here. China is trying to, step by step, ensure itself a supply of energy resources and natural resources that it needs for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years. It's trying to do so through long-term contracts and through actually buying companies. The question that Alaska has to ask itself is the following. A natural resource-based economy can only go so far. Because there will be technological changes. Technology is moving so fast in so many resource areas that new resources will be opening up. They may not be in Alaska. To base an entire economy or a large part of an economy on natural resources is potentially dangerous. It's important to diversify an economy. The most important resource any economy has is human capital. Now, that's an ugly word that signifies basically brain power. It means education. It means good schools. It means early childhood education, good university-trained people, so that over the very long term, whether we're talking about Alaska or Australia or any other natural resource-based economy, it's very important to keep in mind that the human beings that inhabit that area and their brains are the most important resource of all.
There's been a lot of time spent trying to figure out what to do to build economies in rural Alaska. We're seeing a lot of outflow from villages. Younger people like the idea of a traditional life, but it's harder and harder to maintain. Fuel prices out there can be $9 a gallon for gas and home heating fuel. Are there things that you can think of that can help areas such as we see here?
Number one, because we live in an internet age, it is possible for people to be very creative and do an awful lot of innovative things, but not be in a city. In fact, they do have to have internet connections, and that kind of infrastructure becomes very, very important, but they don't have to be in any particular location. They can have the best of all worlds. They can have a beautiful and captivating environment, and they can also be adding a great deal of value to the global economy that is intellectual value through their computations. Secondly, we see the world over a rise in ecotourism, people who love to be out in the wild and who love the wilderness and who can't do it very much. They can only do it maybe a few weeks a year, but they understand the almost spiritual quality that comes from that that access. Put those two industries together, and you find you can have the kind of rural wealth and rural economy and economic activity that you couldn't have had 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. Spread. Now, look into the future in terms of both technology, internet-based technology, and also the growth of kind of environmentally sensitive tourism, and you see two graphs, if you will, that kind of take off where there will be more and more jobs for more and more people.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at Berkeley and is the former labor secretary for President Bill Clinton. New data released by the Alaska Department of Health continues to show that Alaska has among the highest work-related fatality rates in the nation. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
The state section of epidemiology recently released a bulletin that outlined the work-related injuries and deaths that occurred in Alaska between 2001 and 2010. During that time frame, there were over 3,100 non-fatal and 384 fatal work-related injuries reported in Alaska. The bulletin was written by Deborah Hull Gilley. She's the health program manager for the Department of Health and Social Services Injury Surveillance Program. She believes the state gets fairly accurate data about the number of people injured or killed as part of their jobs.
Fatal injuries are captured a number of different ways. One is that there is mandatory reporting to our Department of Labor. But also, we work with a number of agencies real time to collect all of the information on fatal injuries and try to consolidate that and aggregate the information so we have a better picture of what's going on. The non-fatal injuries is a little trickier in that we do have the Alaska Trauma Registry, which collects information from all 24 hospitals around the state. What is more difficult is capturing the information on those less severe injuries.
Some of the data about work-related injuries is not surprising. For instance, 86% of the non-fatal injuries were to men, 91% of the fatal injuries struck men. 73% of the non-fatal injuries were suffered by those identified as white, and the percentage jumped up to 75% of the fatal injuries. 33% of the fatal injuries in Alaska between 2001 and 2010 struck commercial fishermen, but only 9% of the non-fatal injuries happened to commercial fishermen. Hull Gilley notes that 19% of non-fatal injuries happen to construction workers.
Construction and aviation have always been in the top five for fatal injuries, but when looking at the non-fatal side of hospitalized injuries, construction workers have that highest rate of injury for hospitalization.
In the bulletin, the Department of Health notes that non-fatal injury prevention efforts should focus on preventing falls and increasing the routine use of fall prevention equipment, especially in the construction industry. Hull Gilley confirms she and others in the section of epidemiology hope to do some more in-depth analysis of the numbers.
So we're able to do some analysis for regions, and then eventually we hope to be able to do some spatial mapping of the information and put it out on the website. That's where we're going next, is to bring this out so it's easily accessible to our working population.
The bulletin from the section of epidemiology stresses that employers should assess injury hazards and allow workers to help identify unsafe working conditions. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
A 50-year-old Eagle River man is listed in critical condition today, 3 days after he was mauled by a bear. His injuries are more serious than first believed. Bob Eder was taken to Providence, Alaska Medical Center in Anchorage following the Sunday attack, about 2 miles from the Eagle River Nature Center. Police at the time said he was transported with non-life-threatening injuries. His scalp and leg were clawed by the brown bear, which was thought to have 3 cubs with it. The animal ran off after the attack.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The Rasmussen Foundation Sabbatical Program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
A report commissioned by a private nonprofit suggests that seniors in the Matanuska-Susitna borough are not getting adequate access to care facilities. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, many of the borough's small-town senior care centers are banding together to help cut costs and facilitate deliveries, but those efforts are not enough in the face of a rapidly growing senior citizen population.
The Matsu Health Foundation, along with other agencies, commissioned the McDowell Group report. It indicates that not only is Matsu's senior population growing at a rate 5 times the national average, the area's huge geographical size makes delivery of services to seniors a challenge. Matsu's population is spread out over 24,000 square miles, an area about the size of West Virginia. Elizabeth Ripley is executive director of the Matsu Health Foundation, a nonprofit that is a part owner and operator of the Matsu Regional Medical Center.
Well, Matsu is one of the only places in the state of Alaska where the in-migration of seniors is greater than the out-migration of seniors. So we have more seniors moving in and retiring in Matsu than are leaving. And I think that one huge driver of that is our proximity to Anchorage. The other piece that's driving it is that we're seeing seniors move here from out of state to be with their children.
Rachel Greenberg, deputy director of Matsu Senior Services in Palmer, says Matsu has shown an incredible 117.3% growth since the 2000 census, and the senior population is up more than 71% since the same time period. Greenberg says that growth is strapping senior budgets all around.
If you look at both congregate meals and home delivered meals, we've seen an increase of 11% between fiscal year 2011 and fiscal year 2012. It's pretty phenomenal, and that was just over 1 year.
Congregate or communal meals are up 15% this year, and Meals on Wheels are up 9%, she says, and donations for those meals are down, according to officials at Palmer's Senior Center. Greenberg says seniors don't have enough spare cash these days to drop a dollar or two into the donation box.
What we're finding is that seniors are relying on our meal program and transportation program more and more simply because their income has remained fixed and all the other costs has gone up.
Matsu Senior Services transportation budget is spent on bringing seniors to centers to eat meals together, since the philosophy is to keep seniors in independent homes as long as possible, but bring them to the Center for Social Connections. The state of Alaska, although generous with its share of senior care dollars, adheres to a financial structure that does not foster cooperation among the various elder care organizations, according to Elizabeth Ripley.
The way the state system is set up, the system operates on a competitive, not a collaborative model. The way that the grants are funded and applied for drives competition as opposed to collaboration. You know, and so one of the findings of the report is that there's a role the state can play to encourage collaboration and increase efficiency and minimize duplication.
Ripley says there are no defined service areas, so some senior care organizations provide meals in areas covered by other senior centers, angling for a state reimbursement. On top of that, the state lumps Matsu in with the Kenai and Valdez-Cordova areas as one service region. The report calls for a reexamination of the state funding formula. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
New computer models predict climate and ecosystem changes for Alaska and Western Canada. The CLIOMES models were produced by University of Alaska Fairbanks and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service scientists. One of the primary creators, forest ecologist Nancy Fresco with UAF Scenarios Network for Alaska and Arctic Planning, says the models confirm climate-driven change.
What plants and animals are on the ground and how are they going to be affected by climate, or how might they be affected by climate? And I think that's something that we're already seeing. We're seeing species show up in places where they weren't before, and we're trying to apply that to our models and figure out how to do a little bit of prediction.
Fresco says the project is unique in forecasting regional climate change and associated ecosystem shifts for such a large area at 30-year intervals through 2090. She says one example of the predicted change is species common to far southern Canada moving into western Alaska.
Prairie grasslands that you'd see in Alberta or Saskatchewan, that may or may not occur according to whether the changes in the soils take place and according to whether the species actually get there. But I think that one take-home lesson from that is that even if we don't see the new species coming in right away, we'll know that a lot of the systems that are there might start to get stressed because they're going to be existing in a climate that is not the same climate that we have now and that we've had historically.
Fresco says the situation can result in ecosystem mismatches in which some species are absent at key times.
So that you'll have something like birds hatching out earlier, but the species of insect that they need to feed on isn't there yet. Or the other way around, the insects show up first and then the birds show up too late. So you can get real problems that way when some species move quicker than others or are more flexible than others. And we're already seeing some of that on the landscape too.
Fresco says a forecast ecosystem shift in interior Alaska calls for Fairbanks to become more like Anchorage, with less permafrost and bigger trees. A final report on the CLIOMES project is available for public download. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at alaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.